Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome back. So let's take a few minutes to review what we've seen the past few weeks, what we saw last week, really, and then move forward. And today we're going to really develop Ezra as a person, as a figure in Tanakh. We're going to start to develop his leadership skills. And the reason why we're going to do that is because before we start learning the book of Nehemiah and we get introduced to him, one of the fundamental exercises that we are going to engage in is comparing Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah is really one book. We call them two books, but it's really two paradigms of leaders. Now, we've seen other paradigms of leadership so far. We've seen Zerubbabel, we've seen Yoshua, we've seen Haggai, we've seen Zechariah. But really, obviously, the central figures here are Ezra and Nehemiah. And as we said last week, we had been doing this class for, I think, 10 weeks, something like that, and we hadn't even met Ezra yet. So thankfully, last week we were able to meet Ezra. We were introduced to him as a sofer, and there was a lot of build-up to him coming onto the scene, if you recall. How many generations back does it link Ezra? 17 generations, all the way back to Aaron HaKohen. It introduces him as a sofer, which you and I had agreed upon, connotes some form of a very scholarly, righteous, religious, pious individual. And so when you're introduced to Ezra, you're expecting lots of big things coming from him. And yet, when we started learning about Ezra, so it's a very different picture that emerges. Now, everything we're going to say today is really only half the picture, because we're developing one of the portraits. But as with anything, it's only as good as what you contrast it against. So if I just showed you a room full of black, it's not very nice. But if I put black against white, now all of a sudden we have what to compare and contrast it to. Ezra and Nehemiah are going to be the same way. So a lot of what we're going to talk about today is part of the picture. We're developing one of the characters, and you're going to have to file it away in the back of your mind, because in a few weeks when we get introduced to Nehemiah, then we're going to really start comparing and contrasting the two. So let's jump into Ezra. So we had this vision of a pious, scholarly, righteous sofer. Okay? He's coming back, and he is somewhat enraged by what he encounters when he comes back to Israel. Most notably, what's he enraged by? Well, a number of things. First of all, he's frustrated by the fact that who doesn't come back with him? The Levim. Right? There was a small number of Levim that were with him, and he notices that, and he highlights that for us. The other thing that he encounters, and this is what we spent the bulk of last week talking about, was he encounters intermarriage. And Ezra is pained. I wouldn't say furious. He's more in pain by it. Remember what he did is he tore his garments. He sat in mourning. He fasted. He was mourning. And the people seemed to listen. Now, if you remember all the way to the end of what we did last week in chapter 10, so there are groups of people that return. So if you go to the second to last page of the packet that I gave you today, we'll start backwards and then we'll come forward. English, the Hebrew, the Ezra. We'll get put away the Harvard for a second. We're going to get to that. That's going to be the culmination. Does anyone have extras? There should be, because I made a bunch. If not, maybe two people can share. One. Two. I don't. I made what I made. It's Perek Yud. Pasuk Yud Chet. So you just, you know, we're not even going to read so much, but you're going to say, Vayimtsa mibnei ha-kohanim asher hoshivu nashim nachriot. These are the Kohanim who were found to have taken non-Jewish wives. And it lists them all. Okay? Now remember, anytime you see lists in the book of Ezra, that for us has been a trigger. Right? Lists are significant. So we saw lists all the way at the beginning when Koresh gave permission to come back from Persia. We saw lists that came back with Ezra. And we described when it came to the lists of those who came back from exile, that lists can mean two different things. Lists can either connote a lot, or it can signify a little. And that was part of the whole dynamic that we were discussing at the beginning of the book of Ezra, is are the 42,360 who come back from exile, is that a good number or a bad number? Is the list to show that this is only... Now, to give you the sense of, oh my gosh, there's so many of them. Right, if we were to print a list of all the members and their children and grandchildren at BRS, So that would hopefully be an overwhelming number. You'd look at the list and it would be pages and pages long and you'd say, wow, right? Or numbers, by definition, create a finite nature to it, right? If there's a number, then it's that number and no more. So 42,360, by the Tanakh listing so many of them, it's either to give you the sense of, oh my gosh, there's a lot, I can't even count them all. Or it's to say, no, the fact that you can count it means that it's really not so many. Okay? So counting counts. Just ask our president, who spent a good 6 months obsessed with the number of people that came to his inauguration, right? But because counting is significant, it shows power. There's power in numbers. If you can't even count them, then it means that there were so many there. Now here, lists take on an added significance, because it's not just those who came back or didn't come back, but now we're counting those who intermarried. And again, we're left with the question of, what's the purpose of providing us the list? Is it to show us how many, or is it to show us how few? So comes along the Das Mikra, and he writes the following. All the way at the end of the long list that you have in chapter 10 of the Kohanim that intermarried, in the very last pasuk of the Perek says, Kol Eila Nasu Nashim Nachriot, that all of these married non-Jewish wives, V'yesh Mehem Nashim V'yasimu Banim, and some of them even had children with their wives. Now what's the point of telling me this? So says Zera Kavod in his Das Mikra, Nimtzeinu Lemedim, he says, Ula'el Ne'amar, it's going to, in Pasuk Yid Gimel, it had said, Ki hirbu lifshoa b'davar hazeh. Hirbu lifshoa means that there were a lot of them, that there were a lot of them doing this. He says, from the fact that it says that, Nimtzeinu Lemedim, Shelo Allah bide Ezra lahotzias machshavato lifoal b'shlemut. Ezra was not overly successful. Ad sheba Nehemiah v'higshima b'koach shel tono. Until Nehemiah comes, what's koach shel tono? Strength. Right, and we're going to see that there's going to be a difference in leadership between Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? Ezra says the Das Mikra was largely unsuccessful in his attempts to convince them to abandon intermarriage. And how do we know, says the Das Mikra, that Ezra was largely unsuccessful? The fact that the Tanakh lists all of those who are intermarried. And it says, Ki hirbu, what was the word? Ki hirbu lifshoa b'davar hazeh, because they did so much of this, shows the Tanakh is communicating to us that this was a prevalent problem, even after. Don't forget, this is the end of the book of Ezra. Now, we come back to Ezra and Nehemiah. He makes a cameo appearance. But at least what we know up until this point, says the Das Mikra, is that Ezra was largely unsuccessful. Lists are to show how significant the number is. And the fact that there's this whole long laundry list of names of intermarried people is there to show you, right, 18 to 44 is how many? Those who are good at math, 26. Wake us at 26, right? So 26 psukim are just listing those who intermarried. Says Das Mikra, that's not a few psukim. That's a large chunk of psukim. It's to show us that the majority stayed intermarried. Comes along the Malbim and says the exact opposite. And the reason why I share with you these contrasting approaches is because this is exactly what we've been talking about the whole time. And by the way, we're going to come back to lists in Nehemiah, and the same theme is going to play out. Says the Malbim, if you want to look it up, it's on Perek Yud, Pasuk Bet. He says, right, Pasuk Bet had said, right, it was the acknowledgement of the sin. Says the Malbim, the fact that it's then going to list all of the names of those intermarried, senasu nashim nachriot, hayu me'atim la'arech ha'am harav shehayu ata be'eretz Yisrael. It's to me'atim. It's to show us how few there are. Uvechol zeh, but nonetheless he says, Hayachet haklali bashir nase befarhesya ve'asarim lo michu b'davar. In other words, he says there was a relatively small number of people that were actually intermarried. What made this such a significant problem was that they were doing it publicly and no one was decrying it, no one was lamenting against it. But you see that the presence of lists can mean two different things to do different mefarshim. To Das Mikra, 26 psukim of lists mean that this is a big problem and that most of them stayed that way. To Malbim, it says, no, the fact that you can list them all, the fact that you can put a number to it, shows that it's a relatively insignificant number. If it's such a relatively insignificant number, why is Ezra so bothered by it? Because it was done publicly. This was the sin of the age. And by the way, you see that throughout history. You see rabbis that spoke out against issues that, I mean, I'm on a recording, but in the larger scheme of things, aren't such big issues. They're not the hills that you and I might choose to die on. But because they were the defining issues of the day, they became a big deal. So let's take, for example, mechitza controversy, right? So mechitza nowadays is somewhat of an innocuous issue. Yes, some love it, some hate it. Some choose not to come into Orthodox shuls because of it. Some are able to tolerate it. But if you go back to the way it was spoken about in the 40s and the 50s, that when there was like a real battle taking place between conservative and orthodoxy and defining the difference between the two of them, mechitza was the issue. And so if you read some of the writings about mechitza in a vacuum, you're like, why is everyone so excited about this? But if you understand in the historical context, you understand that was one of the defining issues of the day. Driving on Shabbos, mechitza, right? These were not just halachic issues, but these were defining halachic issues. They defined the differences between movements. They were significant. So that's what the Malbim says over here by intermarriage. Obviously, intermarriage is bad, says the Malbim. He says, ki chet, was chet klali. It's obviously a terrible sin. What was so bad about it was that no one was protesting against it. And that's why Ezra comes along and says, I have to speak out. So that's in terms of lists. And it's common to the themes that we developed all the way back, I think it was even our second class, first or second class, about the role that lists are going to play in Nehemiah. Is it to show how big it is? Is it to show how small it is? The other thing, if you recall all the way back, which I assume you all do, because you review your notes every night on this class, but there was a third theme to lists that we had developed. And that is that lists don't just define quantity, but it defines methodology. What do I mean by that? The presence of lists in Ezra are actually to minimize the role of the leader and to magnify the role of the people. People play an enormous role in this time period, and Ezra and Nehemiah are trying to express that to us by constantly listing people. Undermining, not undermining, that's a pejorative word, but minimizing the role of the leader and magnifying the role of the people. Now, how do I know this? I know this because of the way Ezra is described. If you recall, Ezra comes onto the scene. He's described as a leader, dating back 17 generations to Aaron. He is the sofer, he's the scribe, he's pious. I'm expecting big things. And what do I get? A leader that constantly pushes the attention away from himself and onto other people. So let's look at some examples. It would have been really helpful if I had numbered these pages. But go to page number... Let's go to page number one. All the way at the beginning of Perek Chet. Right when it introduces us to those who come back from, and we're going to jump around a little bit. That's how we'll keep you awake this morning. The Eila Rashe Avosehem Vihit Yach Sham. These are the families and the genealogies of those who are going to come back. Ha'olim Imi. Ezra says, who come with me. Now, in a vacuum, that's not such a significant term, but when we develop the picture, it's actually a beautiful image. Ha'olim imi means, it's not just me who's coming up, but it's about all of us. It's a collective experience, right? This is the anti-I generation, right? Ha'olim, mimi means we're all in this together. Skip down a little bit. Right, the genealogy, right? Yeah, I understand. Okay. Pasuk Yurchet, Pasuk 18, what's all important? Pasuk 18. V'yaviu lanu kiyad Eloheinu atova aleinu ish sechel mibnei machli ben Levi ben Yisrael v'sheirevia uvanav ve'achav shmonasar. Who does Ezra identify as coming with him? He says, Baruch Hashem, that Hashem sent with me this really wise person who's going to be able to help me along in the process. Right? Is it all about Ezra? No, he's actually identifying other leaders, and he's grateful that there are other leaders that are coming along with him. And then it says, Vet Chashavia, Vito Yeshaya, Ben Mibnei Merari, Echav Uvnei Mesrim. He's describing all of these people that are coming with him. Then he says, 21, that he makes his fast, right, because he's embarrassed. He didn't want to come to the king and ask for military assistance, because then the king would say, how can your God be so strong? So instead, so we prayed to God, and what does he do? He appoints other priests to take on roles of leadership. So it's not all about Ezra. He specifically takes other Kohanim and he appoints 12 of them. Right? 12 Kohanim. And what does he do with them? They are, and you can just turn the page and you'll see, they are in charge of the Beis HaMikdash. They're in charge of the vessels. They're in charge of the valuables in the Beis HaMikdash. So you're starting now to see this image, and I'll give you other examples in a second, but even, we haven't even gotten out of chapter 8 yet, and you see very clearly that it's not all on Ezra's shoulders, but that he's sharing the burden with those around him. That's unique. You don't oftentimes see leaders do that. Go to chapter 9. We're introduced to the intermarriage. Right, Ezra points out the issues. Look at the beginning of chapter 9. Ukechalot Eile, when all of this ended, right? Where am I? Yeah. Nikshu Eilai Hasarim Leimor. Who notices the problem of intermarriage? Is it Ezra who notices it? No. The Sarim, these leaders who he appointed, Nikshu Eilai, they come to Ezra. And they're the ones who tell Ezra, "Lo nivdalu ha'am Yisrael ve'akohanim ve'alevim mi'amei ha'aretzos," that there's a, you know, Ezra, you got an intermarriage problem here. Pasuk Gimel, Pasuk 3, u'kishamias ha'davar hazeh, when Ezra hears about this calamitous problem, karati et bigdimei umi'ili, he tears his garment, ve'emratar misa'ar roshi uzikani, he tears out his hair and his beard. Keep that in mind, because Nehemiah is going to do the exact opposite. Literally the exact opposite. He's not going to tear out his hair. He's going to do it to other people. Okay? No, seriously. Right? It's a different form of leadership. One is focused on your own actions. The other one is changing other people. It's very different. We're going to develop that. Right? So Ezra tears out his hair. And what happens in Pasuk Dalet? Ve'elai ye'asvu. No, Pasuk Dalet. The Eli Yeasvu Kol Chared Bidivrei Elohei Yisrael Al Ma'al Hagola. What happens? Everyone gathers around him. Ve'ani Yoshev Mishomeim Al Minchas Ha'er. He's not even doing anything. Right? He's leading by action. Ezra is approached with a problem. He doesn't even see it. It's these people that he has empowered in leadership skills. They see the problem. They approach Ezra with it. Does Ezra scream and lambast the people and enter into this diatribe about how evil and wicked you are? No. What does Ezra do? He leads by example. He tears his garment. He expresses mourning. And what happens when he does that? He doesn't ask the people to come around him. What naturally occurs? Naturally, they gravitate toward him. That's Ezra's form of leadership. Ezra is not a fire and brimstone leader. He's not going to get up on the rooftop and start screaming and giving mussar and right. He's not that fire and brimstone person. He's a man of quiet action. He's sitting in Times Square, tearing his garments, and all of a sudden everyone says, wait a second, let's gather around him. Let's rally around this form of a leader. Okay? Go to chapter 10 now. Again, you see the same exact image depicted. Pasuk 1. It says a zero there because the one got cut off. But it's chapter 10. You'll trust me. Okay? It's on the top. It says 1834. Ukihispalel Ezra ukihisvado. When Ezra prays and he confesses, bocheh umidnapel lifnei beis Elokim, he cries and he bows down. What happens? Nikbitsu elav miYisrael kahal rav meod. Of an extremely large, right, kahal rav. A very large gathering gathers around him. Anashim, vinashim, viladim, old people, young people, men, women, children. Ki bachu ha'am harbe boche. And everyone is, have you ever been to a Sephardi funeral? Ashkenazim, we're relatively docile at funerals. Sephardim, they're like wailing and weeping and throwing themselves into the grave. It's a different experience, right? Ever been to a Sephardi wedding, a Syrian wedding? Our weddings, they're somber, right? Because the husband and wife know what's about to happen to them. They're somber. Sephardi weddings, they're cheering, they're whooping, they're right. So that's what happened here. There's a little emotion here. But think about the description. Exact same description. Ezra starts. He never says anything to the people. He never says, come join me. He doesn't put out an email blast, a phone tree. He doesn't put it in the weekly. He just sits and he does his thing. And immediately, it's so striking in the pasuk. Nikbitsu elav miYisrael kahal rav meod. Tons of people. Right? The words are significant. Kahal rav meod. Which means a really large audience. Not just one or two people. But a lot of people start crowding around. And then what happens in the very next pasuk? Vaya'an Shechanya ben Yechiel mibnei elam vayomer leEzra. Who takes the initiative here? It's not Ezra. Ezra sits down, but who's once again giving him the advice? It's one of the leaders, Shechaniah ben Yechiel. So he approaches Ezra, and he says, "Anachnu ma'alnu be'Eloheinu v'noshev nashim nachriyo me'amei aretz." He says, "We've transgressed against Hashem." Ve'ata yesh mikveli Yisrael alzos. But Ezra, there's good news, and that is we have a way out. Right, mikveh Yisrael. What's a mikveh? A mikveh is, it's a purify, but it's when nothing else works, so to speak. So you go to the mikveh, right? Think about the last mission in Yoma, right? Mikveh Yisrael Hashem, that the Ashreichem Yisrael, Rabbi Akiva says that Hashem is our mikveh. What does it mean? Hashem is our mikveh. It means that when we run out of all options, we go to Hashem, and He's able to purify us. So that's the imagery that's described here. Yesh mikvah l'Yisrael. Now mikvah also has, right, mikvah means hope, right? They're tied together, right? Hatikvah that we spoke about a couple weeks ago is that same imagery, right? Hope in mikvah, because when you believe that you have no, when you believe you are so filled with sin, what don't you have? Hope. So a mikvah, the notion that God can cleanse us, and the notion, right, a mikvah is similar. They compare it to a mother's womb, emerging from a mother's womb, right? It's a fresh start. So the notion of Hashem as our mikvah is the exact double play on the word. It's what gives us hope, because it means the situation is never fully bleak, because God can always extract us from that situation. So that's the double entendre that's being used here, right? Yesh mikveh l'Yisrael alzot. There's hope. We have our trump card. What do we have to do? Ve'ata nichrat pasagimel 3. Ve'ata nichrat brit le'Eloheinu. we're going to establish a covenant to Hashem. Lahotzi kol nashim vehanolad mehem beatzata adonai vecharedim b'mitzvata Eloheinu v'chatarazi yaseh. What are we going to do? We're going to separate from our non-Jewish wives. We're going to figure out these non-Jewish children. Kum, get up. Ki alecha davar. For the matter rests upon you. Ve'anachnu imach chazak ve'aseh. Who's getting Ezra off the ground? It's not Ezra. It's this guy who comes to Ezra. And he's saying, Ezra, yesh mikvah, there's hope, there's an option, there's a plan B. And what is it? We just have to reestablish the covenant between us and Hashem. Right? Covenant is significant. Anytime the Jewish people have a new mode of operating with God, that's when their new covenant's established. Okay, whenever the rules of engagement have been changed between us and Hashem, that's when classically there's a new form of a covenant being established. Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein has a brilliant article which you can find online about that. He doesn't quote this instance, but about that very idea. Right, Purim is a new covenant. Kimu v'kiblu masha kiblu kvar, that we reestablish our covenant with Hashem. What does that mean, the rules of engagement? That was the first time we appreciated God's divine hand, even during the dark times of exile. So that was a new form of an engagement between us and Hashem. His article is about Yom HaTzmaut. He argues that what makes Yom HaTzmaut a part of a long link in a chain of holidays, of Jewish holidays, is because there was a new covenant that was established with God in the aftermath of the Holocaust, which meant that even after the darkest of time, God, you don't give up on us. And the fact that Yom HaTzmaut signifies that shows that it's a holiday no different than Purim, no different than Hanukkah, because it's formulated in the same fashion. Right? But that's exactly here. Don't forget, where are we now? We are right after the first time that God exiles his people. And the people come back and say, we can still have that relationship with God. But what do we have to do? We have to abide by the rules. And that's why we have to get rid of the problem, right? But again, Pasuk Dalet is such a magnificent Pasuk. Kum! He looks at Ezra. You can almost imagine him. Ezra sitting there on the floor, torn garment, hair falling out of his head, beard, he's yanking on it, he's wailing, everyone's crying and lamenting, and this guy comes over to Ezra. And he comes over to him. He says, Yesh mikvah Yisrael. Ezra, what are you talking about? Of course you know that there's a way out of this. Kum, get up. Pick yourself up off the mat. Ki alecha hadavar. Because it's in your hands. We can change it. This is the fulfillment of what, by the way? This is the fulfillment of everything Haggai and Zechariah told the people. Remember, we hadn't seen this in Ezra, but we had seen it in Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai and Zechariah said, you complain that it's the enemies that are preventing you? No. You hold the keys to all the problems. You just have to make it your business to fix it. So Kumi says, Ki alecha davar, it's in your hands. Ve'anachnu imach, but then the most important part to me is we're with you. Right? We're willing to follow you. Now what's extraordinary about that is that you never see Ezra try to get them to follow him. It naturally happens. Right? Ezra's not a forceful leader. Ezra's not a screaming, fire and brimstone, you gotta follow me, doomsday, the sky is falling, if you don't, we're gonna experience another Holocaust. That's not what Ezra's saying. Ezra very, very quietly, but clearly with conviction, leads by example. And the picture that emerges very quickly is that the people are willing to follow. And so the methodology of leadership that Ezra displays is not one where he demands dependence on him, but rather one which tries to formulate a sense of continuity. Right? Forceful leaders will get what they want. But the second that people have the chance to rebel, what are they going to do? Rebel. Right? A good leader is someone who creates other leaders. Rabbi Sacks writes that in numerous places. Right? He has a great line. I'm forgetting it right now. Right? But something about how great leaders create other leaders. Right? They don't just lead, but they create other people to lead. That is chapters 8, 9, and 10 of the book of Ezra. It's about Ezra's relationship with the people. Now, why is this so significant? Because one of the themes that we touched upon it, but we're going to develop it a lot more as the weeks go on, is Ezra's role in Torah Sheba'al Peh. Okay? The Gemara says that had Moshe Rabbeinu not received the Torah, who would have received it? Ezra. What do we know Ezra was a part of? Anshe Knesset HaGedolah. He was a part of that significant body of people. That what was this? What role did the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah play? Well, they made the Takanos, but where are they living? They're living in transitional moments in Jewish history. Don't forget, what is one of the things that's going to be lacking going forward? We have Chagai Zechariah, we're going to learn a little bit about Malachi, and then what happens right after him? That's it, no more Nevuah. Nevuah was the ultimate crutch for the people. Whenever they needed something, they had a Navi to tell them exactly what God wanted. All of a sudden, Nevuah is going to stop. And with that is going to stop a direct connection to Hashem. And the mode of communicating and experiencing a relationship with Hashem is going to change as well. Which means, right, what is one of the things that the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah instituted? Our Siddur. Right? The Siddur, what greater mode of communicating to God do we have than a Siddur? They didn't need it before that because they had a Navi to help them communicate with God. So when you emerge from a prophet, which is what I'll call top-down leadership, right? Or as our speaker on Shabbos referred to it, grass-top leadership, right? All of a sudden, you're going to need the people to be much more motivated because you won't only have one leader on top that's going to tell everyone what to do, but you're going to need the people to figure it out on their own. And so Ezra represents that transition from grass top leadership to grassroots leadership. And that's why the people are so significant here. That is why there's so many lists. Lists show that people are important. If we just put out that there are 835 members of Boca Raton Synagogue, it's an impressive number. But if I say that there's the Perlmans and the Abadies and the Go, I start listing all the names. What am I showing? I'm showing that each one of you is important. Right? When we list pillars, and we list people that have signed up for the dinner, we list people of the Kol Nidre. So think about what that does. Right? A, it shames those who haven't done it, right? There's clearly that element. But it's because people matter. It's because we value people. We're not just saying you're a number, but each name on that list is important to us. We couldn't have done it without you. Right? That is what's going on here. There's a seismic shift in how leadership is presented. And the perfect person to make it happen is Ezra. Ezra's personality is perfect for cultivating other leaders who are going to take over and ultimately figure it all out going forward. Parenthetically, and then we'll come to the kind of the clincher here. The Malbim points this out. He doesn't realize he points it out, but he does. The Malbim, right at the beginning, when we're introduced to Ezra, the Malbim says, "Who Ezra? Shimon HaTzadik haya mishiarei Knesset HaGedolah." We know from the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Shimon HaTzadik. By the way, of this Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, we know very little about. Considering the role that they play in the transmission of our Mesorah, we know very little about them. We know Shimon HaTzadik, we know Ezra, right? We know Mordechai, I believe, was what, right? But we don't know a lot about them. We're able to piece together. But considering they were such a significant body, we actually know a paltry amount about them. But we know Shimon HaTzadik, the Mishnah, Pirkei Avos. He was Mishiarei Knesset HaGedolah, which means he was the last of them. Okay? And what did they establish? Three things. Torah, Avoda, and Gemilas Chassad. One of the most famous Mishnayos. Okay? Torah, Avoda is davening, and Gemilas Chassad is chesed. Says the Malbim, we see all three of those things in what Ezra does. He says, "Ki bimei Knesset HaGedolah niskab tzuru shlosha amudim eila al yidei gimel anashim mesuyamim." Three different people, each fulfilled one of these things. Al yidei Zerubbabel v'Yoshua, our first leaders, Nivne HaMikdash, Vinisbatsra Amud HaAvoda. That was Avoda. They reestablished the Beis HaMikdash, Korbanos, that was the Avoda. V'acharav Yatza Ezra, afterwards comes Ezra, L'chonein Amud HaTorah. We're going to learn about this more in Nehemiah. Ezra, the sofer, the pious scribe, he's going to be the Torah guy. Remember how he was introduced? As Humahir B'Toras Moshe. He was an expert in the Torah of Moshe. We're going to see it's a little bit more than that, but I don't want to give away all my secrets yet, right? But he was an expert in the Torah of Moshe. And then, who's the last one? Nehemiah. We'll have to see Nehemiah, how he's the Gemilas Chesed guy. He does Chesed. But one of the things that's going to be explicit in the book of Ezra is economic inequality. And Nehemiah is going to fix it all. He's going to do a lot of good for a lot of people. That says the Malbim is the fulfillment of these three pillars of Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim, the Anshei Knesset Gdola, we're so sensitized towards. Let's come back to this thesis that we're developing today. We have Ezra. We expected big things from Ezra. Leader. And what do we see? That Ezra's the leader that actually minimizes his leadership. But by doing so, something amazing happens. What has he done? He builds up everyone else around him. He gets people to rally around him without even asking. He cultivates and develops other leaders to lead the people. It's not all about him, the man, but it's about the movement. And when it's about not the man, but the movement, big things happen. Now, how do I know this? I know this because of the article that you have in front of you. All right? Harvard Business Review, January 2001. You probably know this from where I know this from, which is the book, Jim Collins, one of the most famous self-help management books ever written, Good to Great. So in his pinnacle of his paradigm of what makes a good leader, he calls it level 5 leadership, which is the triumph of humility and fierce resolve. Let's read a little bit. This isn't the whole article. I spliced it for you, but you can Google it for you. What? Do I have the image here? I don't, but you can, oh, it has it on the third page of the packet. Okay. 1971, a seemingly ordinary man named Darwin E. Swift was named chief executive of Kimberly Clark, a stodgy old paper company whose stock had fallen 36% behind the general market during the previous 20 years. Smith, the company's mild-mannered in-house lawyer, wasn't so sure the board had made the right choice, a feeling that was reinforced when a Kimberly Clark director pulled him aside and reminded him that he lacked some of the qualifications for the position. But CEO he was, and CEO he remained for 20 years. What a 20 years it was. In that period, Smith created a stunning transformation at Kimberly Clark, turning it into the leading consumer products company in the world. Outperforming companies like Hewlett-Packard, 3M, Coca-Cola, and General Electric. Turn around. Turn the page. Smith's turnaround of Kimberly Clark is one of the best examples in the 20th century of a leader taping a company from merely good to truly great. And yet, my underline, few people, even ardent students of business history, have heard of Darwin Swift. He probably would have liked it that way. Smith is a classic example of a level 5 leader, an individual who blends extreme personal humility with intense professional will. That is how I would define Ezra. Next paragraph. Level 5 refers to the highest level in a hierarchy of executive capabilities that we identified during our research. Leaders at the other 4 levels in the hierarchy can produce high degrees of success, but not enough to elevate companies from mediocrity to sustained excellence. Right? Continuity. Remember, that's what we're talking about here. Okay? Turn the page. Our discovery of level 5 leadership is counterintuitive. Indeed, it is countercultural. Now, bear in mind, he's writing this in what year? 2001. Think about how leadership has changed in the year 2018, 2019, which I'll call the, well, I won't call anything because I'm a rabbi and can't be political. But just think about it. No, I'm saying he calls it counterintuitive and countercultural in 2001. How much more so is what he's about to describe in, for better or worse, the age of Trump, right? Which is all about the man. Okay? He says, people generally assume that transforming companies from good to great requires larger-than-life leaders, big personalities, like Iacocca, Dunlap, Welch, Galt, who made headlines and became celebrities. Compared with these CEOs, Darwin Smith seems to have come from Mars. Shy, unpretentious, even awkward. Okay, you can skip a little bit. Again, you can read the rest, a lot of it on your own. I want to get to some of my punchlines. Skip two more pages. On the left-hand side, it says, not by level 5 alone. Humility plus will equals level 5. Okay? I have an underline right in the middle of the page. He says, level 5 leaders are a study in duality, modest and willful, shy and fearless. To grasp this concept, consider Abraham Lincoln, who never let his ego get in the way of his ambition to create an enduring great nation. Author Henry Adams called him a quiet, peaceful, shy figure. But those who thought Lincoln's understated manner signaled weakness in the man found themselves terribly mistaken. To the scale of 250,000 Confederate and 360 Union lives, including Lincoln's own. He then brings an example of Coleman Mokler, who's the CEO of Gillette. Similar situation where, again, he displays this level 5 leadership. Skip two more pages. Right in the middle of the page, it says, a compelling modesty. This is the clincher. He says, indeed, throughout our interviews with such executives, we were struck by the way they talked about themselves, or rather, didn't talk about themselves. They'd go on and on about the company and the contributions of other executives, but they would instinctively deflect discussion about their own role. When pressed about themselves, they'd say things like, I hope I'm not sounding like a big shot, or I don't think I could take much of the credit for what happened. We were blessed with marvelous people, right? In other words, they're not just building themselves up, but they're building the team around them up. One level 5 leader asserted, there are a lot of people in the company who could have done my job a lot better. He compares that with other leaders in the next page, who one of the leaders calls himself a Rambo in pinstripes, right? In other words, is it all about them, their strength, their might, their power, or is it about creating other people as leaders around them? And when I read this article, and I'd read the book many years ago, but when I remember the book and then found the article, which is easier to copy than the book, I thought of Ezra. I said, that's Ezra. And you'll see it's going to contrast a lot with Nehemiah, but I think it's very telling also about our day and age, right? He compares, right? What does Collins do? He compares two different types of leaders. Those who make it all about them, big personalities, celebrity CEOs, and those who hunker down with fierce determination and ambition, but also not making it about their own ego. But think about the words he used, right? They built up those around them to make others leaders as well. And as I'm reading this, I say to myself, that's Ezra. That's what makes Ezra so successful as a leader. He's not a king. He's not wielding power and influence to get people to do what he wants. What does he do? He leads by quiet action, quiet conviction. And you see the psukim, as we describe them, are dramatic, that the people gather around him. And it's inexplicable. You're wondering, why are the people gathering around him? What did he do to elicit this form of loyalty from the people? And the answer is level 5 leadership. Right, that's exactly what makes Ezra so good at what he does. He gets what he wants. He gets the results that he's looking for, at least according to most people, not Zera Kavod and Das Mikra, right? But at least from the way we view it, it seems to be working, whether it ultimately does or not. But what's more important is the sustainability of it. Because Ezra realizes that he's going to depart from the scene, there's going to be no more Nevuah, and the people need, this system of Judaism, the system of tradition, needs to be able to sustain itself in the absence of any strong leadership. Because gone are going to be the days of the Nevi'im. And so what we've tried to create today is a profile. Right? If we were all FBI agents, we'd be profiling Ezra. And the profile I hope we're developing is one of this level 5 leadership. Of humility with fierce conviction. Ezra's not all about him. The people rally around him specifically because they gravitate toward him, specifically because of his humility. Specifically because it's not all about him. Now, one of the things we're going to have to learn about is how he contrasts with Nehemiah, who, now that I hopefully painted a picture for you, you'll see Nehemiah is a very different form of leadership. And by the end, you'll see why both were needed. Right? Sometimes you need different types of leaders. Different times call for different types of leaders. And we'll see that the balance of Ezra and Nehemiah is what's going to create the full picture for us in the coming weeks going forward. So, now that we've gotten to know Ezra a little bit, hopefully next week we will continue. We'll start the book of Nehemiah next week. Everyone have a great week.